Hello, and welcome to What Is Pod May Never Die, the Game of Thrones podcast from the Georgetown Voice. Today we will be talking about episode 6 of season 7 of Game of Thrones, Beyond the Wall, second to last episode of the season. I am John Block. Caitlin is out of town this week, so she could not be here, but with me, bringing him back from the episode 2 weeks ago, is Garrett Hink.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Of course. Exciting episode.
Yeah.
A lot happened.
A lot that I am still for what processing, and I am still not sure where this episode will end up in terms of my ratings, in terms of just where it's taking the whole series. And so let's dive in.
Let's dive in. I think maybe we've got a lot of discussion. Maybe things will be clearer by the end of it, hopefully. But yeah, so kind of a random shot at the beginning of the painted table, of the map of Westeros on Dragonstone. Just kind of like a long shot of that. I figured we were going to start in Dragonstone.
They really love those maps this season. They've got Cersei's map. You've got a lot of... they love shooting Dany around the map table in her scenes. I don't know.
So it's like, nice little map shot. But then we start off where the name of the episode brings us. Unlike last week with Eastwatch, where we barely saw it. But we start off basically right away beyond the wall. Gendry is very cold. Never been north.
Yeah.
Tormund is very pleasant. Back in his home turf.
I think the opening scenes of this episode are just an opportunity to have some banter between this type of... this magnificent seven plus some extra rando soldiers. A lot of characters who we've seen in a lot of different storylines are now smashed together like your sort of archetypical band of heroes. It's something that's not really typical for Game of Thrones. So.
Right, you think of it as kind of playing off and sort of subverting kind of a lot of like the fantasy or like the typical heroic tale archetypes.
But is it really subverting? And I think that's... I think it's really
At this point, I would say it's not. That's what I'm saying. In that way, it's not typical of the show. In that it seems at this point there's nothing really below the surface. Like, it very much is like the band of heroes going to fight this enemy. And
yeah.
Like, they're very cut and dry in that way. Whereas, you know, hasn't always been the case. Something the show and books have been known for is kind of subverting that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But... speaking of those random extras, the last shot of Eastwatch, the last episode, just featured kind of the seven main characters going, and I guess people assumed that it was just going to be them, but I guess they needed some extras along for the trip. So there's a handful of I don't know. I would assume they're wildlings, just because that's who was sent to man Eastwatch.
I guess so. Night's Watch.
Could be Night's Watch also. Not really explained. They have no lines. They're just kind of there. Which, on one hand, I'm glad, because it wouldn't really make sense for, like, just the seven to go. Because, like, there would be other people at Eastwatch. On the other hand, like, weirdly, I was really confused when, like, there were a bunch more people in the group. And I was just expecting the seven.
I just think it's kind of a dumb idea at the base of it. Like, why do they need to go this way to find a white, and why do they need to send all these people to do it? And
it really seems like, yeah, very dangerous for like a pretty small reward. Like, I think they assume too much of like, oh, we'll get a white and everything will be solved.
Exactly.
Like,
right.
Yeah. And like, I feel like there's a lot more risk to it than that. Whereas like that might not work out and you're basically facing the whole army just for that like small goal. Anyway,
yep.
We got some other interactions. Gendry is kind of pissed at the Brotherhood Without Banners again, because they sold him into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, kind of gets brushed off. They're like, oh, well, it's kind of how it is. He didn't die, so.
Yeah.
And then Jon tries to give Longclaw back to Jorah. Obviously, it's the Mormont family sword. And he's, I guess, good for him in turning it down. Good for Jorah. Probably the right thing to do, I would say.
I think it fits with the storyline. I just think it's it fits in with Jon's character to be someone to offer it back to Jorah.
Uh-huh.
But it fits in with the storyline for Jorah to refuse it. And fits in with Jorah's character, too.
I think so. I was a little... I don't know if disappointed. I was curious to see that Jorah was sort of, he was like, yeah, like, Ned, they talked about Ned for a bit, and Jorah was like, yeah, Ned wanted to kill me. But, like, I feel like Jorah had some real resentment towards Ned, is the thing that they
he did. Really I do remember him being very resentful of sort of the Ned assuming, like, the guise of morality and being the whole holier-than-thou kind of voice.
Yeah, he had a pretty negative opinion of Ned after being exiled. But that was kind of, they didn't really touch that. They were just kind of like, he wanted to kill me, and then he didn't, and we're here. Hmm. And so, after all those interactions, we jump down where Tormund considers south, but most people consider north, to Winterfell, where we've got a scene between Arya and Sansa. Arya starts by telling the story of how she would, you know, shoot arrows in the yard when no one was there and practice because she wanted to be a fighter, and how there's one time Ned watched her and, like, clapped when she got a bullseye. It was fine.
That's a callback to the first episode of the series, even.
That's true, when she shot that arrow when I think it was Bran was shooting and kind of being bad, and then she, like, hits one from far away. So clearly the training worked even back then.
Yeah, there's been a lot of callbacks to the very beginnings of the series. Now that sort of the Stark children are returning to Winterfell, there's a lot of this homecoming and bringing up the laundry from the past. And so what I thought was surprising was that Arya actually reads the letter that she found in the last episode in Littlefinger's bedroom, I guess, out loud to Sansa. And it was the letter that Sansa was forced to write by Cersei, asking her brother to come to terms with Joffrey and the Lannisters in order to allegedly save her father. Now, I thought it was pretty surprising that Arya read out loud the letter to Sansa in the first place. I think it would have made a bit more sense for her to not give up that she had read it. But as sort of a plot point or a device for inspiring conflict between them, I get that they are definitely very different. They have very different personalities, and they always were in conflict as children. And their sort of journeys have been very different throughout the course of the show, and now they've ended up both here at Winterfell. So it makes sense for them to come into conflict, but it does seem like kind of a weak justification that this letter would be that thing that would set it off.
Yeah, and I've brought this up before on earlier episodes of the podcast, but I like the conflict between Arya and Sansa from a broader standpoint. I think, you know, obviously they didn't get along when they were together at the beginning of the show and before that. And it makes sense, like, obviously Arya has kind of become a less trusting person, and then Sansa has kind of been with the enemy so often that, you know, it makes sense that Arya would, you know, mistrust her, and that could lead to problems and conflict. So I like that they're building that up. I think that makes a lot of sense, as opposed to just everything in Winterfell being kind of, like, cut and dry, or even with, like, the obvious good guys in the Starks and the obvious, like, Schemer and Littlefinger. I like how there's kind of tension within the characters that we like, or that are supposed to be, like, good characters. But I really think the letter just makes no sense as an inspiration for conflict. I mean, like, they even bring it up in the scene how Sansa is forced to write the letter and Arya believes her. She's just basically like, oh, but, like, why weren't you stronger? She's like, I was, like, a little girl and, like, in a clearly very vulnerable state, like, being a prisoner of the enemy. And, like, what bothers me even more is, like, that's so obvious to everyone else. Like, because she sends that letter and, like, Catelyn and Rob get that letter and are like, obviously she's being forced to write this. It's not like, oh, like, Sansa is doing this thing. It's like, oh, clearly she's the prisoner of the Lannisters, and they made her write this letter. And so when Arya's like, oh, I'll go to all the Northern Lords with this and see what they think, I would have no reason to believe that they wouldn't think the same thing.
And that's just showing Arya sort of, even though she's allegedly, like, grown up and become sort of this assassin, she lacks political knowledge and subtlety. She lacks, like, the ability to just understand how these things work. And she thinks everything is about, like, an individual contest of, like, strength versus weakness. And so that kind of black and white worldview is going to create conflict when she has to deal with, like, other people.
Yeah, I agree. And I think so it could make sense. I agree with you there that it could make sense from Arya's perspective, just given her naivety, I guess, from sort of a political standpoint. But I feel like what they're trying to do with Sansa's character is have her finally be, like, politically savvy and, like, good at playing the Game of Thrones. And yet she doesn't realize something that seems very obvious, in that the letter is not actually a threatening thing to her. It doesn't make her really look bad, given the circumstances that should be pretty clear to everyone.
Are you saying that Sansa's, like, reaction to the letter is what does make sense?
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. So from Arya's perspective, you could make the case that it's, okay, she doesn't understand, you know, and she's untrusting. But, you know, if they're going to have Sansa, like, be a good ruler now and you know, be savvy politically, then why wouldn't she realize the kind of, what seems obvious to me in that the letter isn't really that important?
Yeah. And, well, we'll get into Sansa's later actions in the rest of the episode discussion, but safe to say, I think Sansa, it's just a testament that both sort of Stark children have a lot more. They're definitely not, like, fully fledged actors in their roles, and now they're being kind of thrust into new things. So,
yeah, that's fair. So we return briefly beyond the wall, a conversation between the Hound and Tormund, which are, like, such two, like, similar characters in a lot of ways, of just, like, being, like, huge and strong, but also, like, boisterous and kind of, like, sources of comic relief while also being, like, valuable in other ways. And Tormund's kind of ribbing at the Hound for his burns. I felt, honestly, you kind of convinced me that, like, that Tormund kind of talking about the burns wasn't that weird. Like, it makes sense that he could see the scars and all that. So I buy that. But, like, just generally the banter they have, I feel like they're like, oh, we have to have these two characters, like, have this banter. And it felt a bit forced to me.
A bit. But I thought that there were some good lines, you know. Tormund is after Brienne.
He really is. He's gunning for it. And the Hound, probably not thrilled about that, because he doesn't like Brienne after she, kicked his ass.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was okay. I guess maybe I expected more from those two characters. But I mean, it was fine. Nothing too troubling. And then the other conversation we got there was between Beric and Jon, who I was interested to see this conversation, given that they're the two characters in the show who have come back to life. Obviously, Beric many more times. And I think they both sort of struggled with the concept of, like, why me? Like, why am I brought back? Am I the same? And I think, you know, I would have liked to see them have more opportunities to talk about that. But I was glad that they touched on some of those points in that conversation.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the struggle of what's my purpose. And at least this dialogue, even though I think that I guess some of the plot has gone away from the original roots of Game of Thrones and the spirit of some of it. I think the dialogue kind of captures the questioning of purpose that at least Beric and Jon and Jon talk about a lot. So anyway,
that makes sense. So then we move down to Dragonstone, a nice conversation between Daenerys and Tyrion, him sort of trying to advise her, going over the plan, of convincing Cersei, kind of the uneasiness, especially on Daenerys' side, of meeting with Cersei and going to King's Landing, given that you're kind of walking into the lion's jaws, so to speak, with that. And then I like Tyrion kind of is trying to, after we saw the conversation with Tyrion and Varys last episode, where they were kind of talking about the Mad King and kind of getting Daenerys to not go down that road of being super violent and reactionary. And so Tyrion sort of brings that up to her and kind of is like, oh, you're prone to anger, you know, to angry outbursts. And her reaction to that, of course, is to get angry.
Yeah. I think Dany is now determined. Dany gets in these moods of like, oh, I'm just going to do whatever the opposite of the person who advised me badly the last time did.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so she's like, Tyrion, you told me to stay put, and now I'm going to leave.
Right? It's like, okay, yeah. I mean, he was outwitted with Highgarden especially, and then to an extent with getting the army from Dorne as well.
But he raises a good point, you know? He raises the point of the succession in this discussion.
That's true.
Like, who's Danny's heir? The dragons? Are Danny's children the dragons?
That doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
That doesn't make sense. And she doesn't have any other family,
that, allegedly. Allegedly. Obviously, Jon is a Targaryen, but we don't... No one knows that except Bran at this point. And so... Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very valuable point, and then one that Danny takes offense to, I guess. I mean, understandably, given that, like, saying that is basically like, oh, like, you could die, like, what's going to happen then? And so she probably doesn't want to think about the fact that she could die. But it is a pretty good point. There's really no logical person who would succeed. There's no Targaryens that we know of. She hasn't appointed anyone, and clearly she isn't going to until she wins the throne, which I guess somewhat makes sense. Although, like, at this point, that means that if she dies before taking the throne, her cause is essentially lost. There's no one to sort of take up the crown and lead the battle afterwards.
Yeah. And she's definitely a person who's not the hardened warrior around. You know, we saw in the episode with the loot train battle.
So bad. So badly named.
That she's really willing to dive into the fight herself, even though she doesn't have a lot of experience. And you know, we see that later in this episode, so...
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I think you also see a similar situation in King's Landing, where Cersei's queen now, but all of her children are dead. I mean, hypothetically, there's Jaime, but he doesn't want to rule, I don't think. And then after him, you know, there wouldn't be anyone.
I mean, it's just the show tying up loose ends.
Yeah, I think so. There's just, you know, at this point, they don't need, you know, they're not planning. If they're planning to kill off one of the kings or queens, like, that's going to be a big thing. There's not going to be a successor after that. That's going to be the end, you would think, given how little time there is. So they don't need to have these heirs given, you know, to take up the mantle.
Right. You know, in the books, you've got Lannisters running out the ass, like...
Lannisters of Lannisport, Lannisters of Castle Rock, somehow other Lannisters of somewhere else, who knows?
In the show, there's only, like, three left.
Yeah, there are only three left. That'd be funny if Cersei and Jaime died and then Tyrion took the Iron Throne as the last Lannister. I think, hypothetically, I guess because Jaime, it seems like, is no longer in the Kingsguard, it would be him next. But then Tyrion, if you went by, you know, assuming Cersei was the rightful queen,
right,
would be second in line.
I forget which one's older, Cersei and Jaime.
Well, Cersei's older. I think Jaime came out clutching her ankle, is I think what it was. But, I mean, by, you know, the laws of Westeros, Jaime would hypothetically be the king before Cersei were the queen, just because he's a male, she's a female. Obviously, she took the throne by less than lawful means. But...
Anyway.
Yeah. Well. So we can move on from that. The point is that there are a few people left. So if people are going to die at this point in the show, it's probably the end for their cause.
Yeah.
So we return beyond the wall. We're now in the midst of a snowstorm. As is appropriate for far north in the middle of winter.
And there's a mysterious beast, a large bear creature that is a white that, you know, attacks them and comes out of the snow.
Grabs one of the random extras and tears them to pieces. I will say, for a second, not for very long, but for a second... Before you really knew it was a bear, when you just kind of saw this white creature in the distance, I was like, could that be Ghost?
Yeah.
Because I think like a Ghost, wolf. Yeah, it did a bit. And I'm pretty sure Ghost is still at Winterfell at this point. But also, why would Jon not have Ghost with him? It makes so little sense. Ghost is so valuable there.
I think they've really forgotten about the direwolves.
They really have. They had that one scene with Nymeria that was kind of random. It doesn't... I figured that she was going to come back or something, and now it really doesn't seem like it.
I don't
Ghost
understand.
Hasn't been in the season at all.
Yeah. I just think that Weiss and Benioff are kind of clumsy storytellers.
It kind of seems like that. Or maybe the writers, because I don't know how much they're I assume they obviously are contributing somewhat, but also the writers on a more minute sense. Because you can have the direwolves in without them playing a major role, too. And so I feel like maybe in the broad drafting of the story, they weren't included in anything major. But then I guess they just got left by the wayside in the minutia of filling it out, which is disappointing. Because I think when you have a direwolf, like with Ghost, who's the one who's like actually still with his owner and John, like, and you're going beyond the wall to fight White Walkers, like,
yeah,
why would you not take your savage wolf who is super good at fighting?
Well, John, well, I think the argument could be that John went to Dragonstone and then he went directly up to Eastwatch. So he didn't have time to have Ghost come up to the Eastwatch.
Yeah, that's true. It does make sense, but, like, I think it's just disappointing that they haven't utilized that. I mean, that's one of his... I think that's, like, a huge asset. If you thought, like...
Can you imagine if John had brought Ghost with him to Dragonstone and then, like, the Ghost-Dragon interactions?
That would be incredible. I would have loved to see that. I don't think the show will ever admit this, but I think the CGI budget for the dragons, like, really made them, like, have to not do as much with the direwolves.
Like, yeah, I think the fact in the earlier seasons, yeah. But, I mean, now they have a shit ton of money.
No, I think even that, I think... Or maybe it was a time constraint and not a money one. Of, like, it took so much time to do all the dragon stuff that, like, they couldn't...
How much did the wolves even take?
Apparently, like, more than the dragons.
Really?
Yeah, I read something that's saying, like, 'cause to do all the hairs on the wolf is, like, really time-consuming and things like that. So, yeah, I mean...
Interesting.
I would have liked to see Ghost. I thought it was Ghost for a second. Obviously, that doesn't really make sense if he just ran out of me on the wall. It was a white bear. And then they go to battle, and it soon becomes a flaming white bear as it gets hit with a flaming sword from Thoros.
And takes down Thoros and really does a number on him.
Really, really tears him up.
And then, you know, the hound just donks him on the head and he dies and...
No, it's, I think it's either Jorah or Beric. The hound gets scared because it's on fire and doesn't do anything.
Someone knocks the bear on the head, it dies, and drag Thoros away, and...
He's surprisingly not that hurt from being gnawed at by a bear for, like, a while.
You know, it's just Game of Thrones the Revenant out here, like...
They kind of, Beric lights his sword up and, like, cauterizes those wounds, and then he's climbing a snowy mountain. Next thing you know.
Good for him. I'm glad that Westerosi men are just so vigorous and...
That's true. Although Thoros, I guess, isn't from Westeros. Thoros of Myr, so he's from the free city of Myr.
That's true. And the Lord of Light.
Lord of Light helps him out, for sure. The one thing I was curious, so the one guy who gets killed by the bear...
Uh-huh.
I guess it doesn't work in the show because they've established it as the White Walkers have to kind of, like, manually turn someone into a white.
Uh-huh.
They don't just come back. But I feel like earlier it was like they would be more likely to come back.
Yeah, I think it's like a proximity thing. I think if they're sort of in the immediate neighborhood of a White Walker, they kind of rise back up.
Fair enough. So I was curious of that, but obviously the getting the white is solved soon after. But before we get there, a quick trip back to Winterfell.
Yes.
Now Sansa and Littlefinger.
Littlefinger tells Sansa, "Hey, you know, this whole thing is kind of, you know, it could get dangerous for you. But you should definitely keep Brienne around."
He does, yeah, he's like, oh, keep Brienne around. I think the more important thing there is he's trying to build up the conflict between Arya and Sansa, obviously.
He does.
To a good effect, I think. I think he's playing Sansa pretty well. What I'm curious of is, like, Sansa, so far this season, has been super, like, not trusting of Littlefinger and, like, kind of, like, putting him off, like, pretty constantly. But then she just goes to him and, like, confides the whole letter thing.
Well,
like,
I think that she's now been kind of thrown one by this situation and is now really uncertain with what to do. And she, as I think she mentions in the earlier scene with Arya, Littlefinger is the one who actually supports her, right? Littlefinger is the one whose knights are coming to save her, who came to save her in the battle. And so she knows that he, at least... on a base level, wants to help her.
That's fair.
But I think that it is, I also agree with you, like, why has she not lost her suspicions? Like, why has she not really lost her... Is there not some wheel in the back of her mind saying, like, Littlefinger might be behind this, right?
Yeah, maybe not even behind it, but just, like, maybe I shouldn't be so open and trusting to him, especially when she hasn't been for the rest of the season. Like, she's been pretty off-putting towards him. And then to just kind of go a full 180 there was, like, a bit jarring, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, back beyond the wall, I like this interaction between Jorah and Thoros talking about the Greyjoy Rebellion, because they were both like two of the big heroes from that battle when they stormed Pyke. Mm-hmm. That's where Jorah became like won his knighthood. He got knighted after that battle, and then obviously what Jorah brings up, Thoros and his flaming sword scaling the walls, was kind of like this iconic image of the battle also. So that was pretty cool to talk about. We haven't gotten a lot of that as much lately, kind of going back into the history and, like, the lore of Westeros. So I like that a lot. But then Jon and Tormund, or really, really Tormund here or something, and then he and Jon go and spy, I guess, like, a scout troop of White Walkers.
Yeah, why do they need scouts? I don't know.
I'm not really sure they have this giant army. They could just...
They attack... They kill the White Walker and all the other... Most of the Whites then, like, collapse, but there's one left. Yeah. They later kind of offer some, like, explanation of, like, the one White Walker who, like, raised them...
When you kill them, all the Whites that he raised die. It's kind of confusing, but, like, whatever, I'll just accept it. I'm glad they bring that up later, which I'm glad they did, as opposed to just not explaining it at all and having, like, all those Whites crumble except one when they need exactly one. It's still, like, very convenient for the plot, but at least they gave some explanation for it, even if it wasn't an amazing one. So I think that's better than not doing anything.
Yeah. So then they see all the other Whites, and they're like, oh, crap, we actually had no plan, and this is a terrible idea.
Yeah, there's like, all right, fine, we can take the scout troop of, like, 10. But then, you know, when it's this giant army. So they send Gendry back to send a raven.
And they like, say to Gendry, look, you're the fastest, and also you can run the fastest without your hammer. And they deprived us of really seeing Gendry with the hammer in action.
That was upsetting. Also, I guess it makes sense that he's the fastest, given that, aside from Jon, who you assume is going to stay, everyone else is kind of old. And obviously, like, Thoros is injured. Beric is undead. But... I like to think that they just had, like, a race before leaving in case they needed to know. Like, they just ran around, they did, like, a lap around Eastwatch, and Gendry won, so he became the designated guy to run back to Eastwatch if they needed him.
The runner, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he sets off, and then that whole army is just, like, there real quick.
Yeah, and they, like, run across an ice lake, and then they kind of get on this island, and then the Whites fall in the water, and they all are around the island. It's very dramatic.
It's very, yeah, they're just, like, they've really played up, and I think they did this a lot with Beyond the Wall, of just, like, the big shots, like, the wide shots of, like, the landscape and the snow, and then of, like, that army and the Whites falling into the lake.
So this is from the after the episode, but it was, like, one of the showrunners explaining, they were saying, like, well, how do we game out a scenario when they, like, can survive for an extended period beyond the wall, and we figured that they had to have run across some kind of lake where the
it's the only explanation.
And okay, that just tells me a bit that, like, they didn't really think out this idea that they had for the plot. Mm-hmm. Right, like, they didn't really think out, like, yeah, we'll have them all go on beyond the wall and then the dragons will come, right?
I mean it is what it is, I guess. You could put so many plot holes in that. Like, A, the White Walkers are literally, like, ice creatures.
Right.
Like, you don't think that they could, like, make the water cold enough to walk over. And, like, also, they wait out the night there when it gets colder, so you'd think the lake would freeze over then more so you could walk across it.
White Walkers don't really do anything.
They just are literally standing there. It makes not a lot of sense.
If I was a White Walker, I would have attacked at night.
That's true, yeah. It's colder at night. They're, like, people were asleep. But whatever.
So, make it through the night.
Make it through the night. Well, almost everyone makes it through the night. Except for poor Thoros. Died in his sleep, as the Hound points out. Like, definitely not the worst way to go. Gets given his last rites. And then Beric sets him on fire with his sword. That's a really useful sword. Sets a bear on fire. Really good for killing wights. Cauterized wounds. Funeral pyres.
Beric's one of my favorite characters. And I really thought that this would be, you know, the end of both Thoros and Beric, because I can't really see them going on without each other.
That's true. Well, especially for Thoros, because, like, he's pretty tied to Beric. But I definitely thought Beric was going to die.
Yeah.
But he did not. Only Thoros. Of the seven main characters who went beyond the wall at the end of last episode, only Thoros. Everyone else makes it through the battle. So Gendry makes it back to the wall. He, quite the runner. Literally can't run anymore, collapses right
within
at the wall.
5 feet of the wall, and they're like, oh wait, let's just open up.
And then they also, it's at night still when he gets back. It's still a snowstorm. They can only see from a 700-foot high wall of ice. The fact that they saw him, like, whoever was on lookout, like, eyes of a hawk. Really amazing that they spotted him. But he makes it back, and then, so he's like, oh, we need to send a raven to Daenerys. Davos is there. Got him in for, like, 3 seconds this episode. That was nice.
That was nice.
So they obviously send the raven back. And then, so the battle's about to start, or is going to start soon, now that it's morning again, for some reason, even though night would have made way more sense. And Beric, I like how Beric proposes, like, oh, we can't win this fight, let's just kill the Night King, and that'll solve it. It's like, ah, pretty easy, I'm sure that'll happen.
I'll just go through this whole army. And,
yep, just thousands and thousands of wights. But a couple scenes before we get to the battle proper. First, at Winterfell, an invitation to Sansa to go to King's Landing. Unclear, I think, who it's from.
The context of that was a little unclear to me.
Yeah. I wasn't exactly sure. But she wisely decides not to go. I would say unwisely decides to send Brienne to
then
King's Landing.
Brienne also wisely says, Sansa, this might not be a good idea because, you know, the whole thing with loyalty and, like, being betrayed, which is, like, the whole, really, like, the whole thing that everyone in this entire country is about.
Yeah, I mean, she's pretty clearly loyal. I think Sansa trusts. And Brienne is like, yo, I'm clearly very obviously loyal to you. Like, I did, there was that whole thing when she was with Ramsay, and then there was, she got sent to River Run and
came back.
Here's
my question, though.
Yeah.
Like, this is more of a broader context question. Like, why do people in Westeros trust anybody?
It makes
after all
so little sense. If in, at the beginning, sure, when there's less scheming, like, if you're Ned and you've basically been in the North for your whole life, except for a war, or two wars, I guess, and, like, people are loyal to you, then, like, fair. Like, you can generally be somewhat trusting. But, like, if you're Sansa, and you've seen all the shit that she's seen, and then Brienne points out to you, like, oh, you've got all these men? Yeah, Littlefinger's here, and he's, like, the schemer of all schemers. How do you know he hasn't, corrupted those guys? And she's just like, shut up, go. I think that was a really bad decision.
A classic Stark move.
It really is. Like, listen to the people who give you good advice. Don't listen to the people who give you bad advice.
And also for Brienne, too. Like, Brienne's not exactly, like, your scheming cookie, you know? Like,
right, Brienne's not, like, Brienne's the one you can trust.
You know, and but Brienne's also not, like, she's not going to, she's not the most perceptive person either, you know? Like,
and even she realizes
it. Even she realizes it, and whatever. The plot must go forward, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess the one thing will be, I guess we'll see Brienne. I'm sure she'll
zip
through the heavy snows of the North and make it to King's Landing by next episode.
You know,
probably.
Just to the war zone or the Riverlands.
It just,
then.
Yeah. So that'll be interesting to see her again in the context. Obviously, obviously with Jamie, and then like in the context of King's Landing and all that, I wonder who else she might see there. I wonder, it seems like she's bringing Pod, because she was like, oh, let Pod stay at least, and Sansa was like, no. So I'm curious if she gets there to when there's the meeting. It looks like in the Dragon Pit, given the preview for next episode, which is cool, because we haven't seen that yet. And then it'd be cool if Pod got there and reunited with Tyrion. And Bronn.
And
that's Bronn. Those are the reunions I really want to see. That's the...
So many reunions.
Yeah. And the next scene is back at Dragonstone. Daenerys has received the letter from Eastwatch about the gang being in trouble. I wonder how specific it was, because when she gets there, she, like goes to right where they are.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, they're trapped on an island in a lake at these exact coordinates. Help. But so, her outfit was fairly interesting.
I was like, all right, you're just going to wear your like, bathrobe.
It really kind of looked like a white bathrobe.
Like,
I don't know.
It didn't have any, weird. Like, pants, like...
That's her winter battle attire, I guess.
I feel like even Sansa's got, like, North pants, like...
True, it's true. And so Tyrion is kind of persuading her to not take action. Like you said, he's like, oh, do nothing. And then she's like, you say do nothing? That means I must do something. So she hops on Drogon and heads north with her two other dragons, with Viserion and Rhaegal. Which I was a little confused, because how does she, like, command them to come with her?
How does she clearly command she them has to control come with... When she goes anywhere, you know, like...
Yeah, they really haven't explained that a whole lot, given that how... I guess it makes sense that they did that all the time, but then when she attacks the Lannister army, it's just Drogon. The other two don't go. So that was a little confusing, given the most recent time we've seen the dragons in action. It was just one. But whatever. I don't really care that much. It was just something I noted. And now, the important stuff, the battle at the lake beyond the wall. The Hound kicks it off by deciding to throw stones at the whites for no reason. Once, you know, doesn't go far enough, skids across the ice. The whites, I guess, now realize that, oh, it's actually frozen enough, but they didn't before.
Just
they decided
to
not to test.
People on ice islands should not throw stones.
And so they attack in full force. Well, really kind of one at a time, and
obviously
a lot of one at a times.
Just the one at a time. At one point, you know, there was a long sequence when we thought Tormund would look like he was going to get dragged below the water. And during that sequence, I prepared myself to see Tormund die, and then they saved him.
The same thing happened for me up to a certain point where it was like, this has definitely gone on too long for them to kill him now. Like, there's a certain point where you can drag it out, being like, is he going to die? Is he not going to die? And then you can still kill him. But they went past that to the point where it was like, oh, like, no one who, like, is struggling for life for this long dies. Like, at that point, you live. And so he did. But,
and then,
That would have been... They could have killed off one bigger character than
Thoros. They could have killed off at least one more person.
But decided not to. They killed off the rest of the extras. They all died.
But the
fighters are getting our heroes are getting overwhelmed.
John falls back to where?
Notice, they're literally surrounded on the lake. There's nowhere to fall back to. They kind of like go up the rock in the middle, but like really, it's not falling back to anywhere.
The John fall back line, I didn't get that, but whatever. All the plot, whatever, and then dragons.
Right when they're about to be overwhelmed at the top of the rock, Daenerys comes on Drogon with Viserion and Rhaegal in tow, and they start melting the shit out of those whites.
I wonder what percent of the whites got melted, you know? Like, what?
Well, I mean, I would say Dragonfire seems like it would be superior to regular fire.
Sure.
And... So, like, if,
plus
if the whites are getting
factor
hit with those,
in, like, the melting of the ice and
right,
falling
so they're
in.
Right, drowning. Although, I don't know, would drowning even kill them? Probably not.
Probably not.
So the dragons come.
They're all getting on. John decides to go off. And
right, they're like, oh yeah, get on the dragon, and then John is like, he literally is like about to like reach out and grab Danny's hand.
But then why does he turn around?
It's like there's a white coming, and like he's like, oh, let me kill this white and then keep going further away to fight more whites. It's like you could have just gotten on and it would have been fine.
And then the White Walkers basically take up the same strategy from the previous battle.
Right?
Let's throw something at the dragons.
It's like
and then
big weapon, big sharp arrow or spear.
This one is infused with White Walker magic,
right?
Apparently.
Some magic ice spear.
Takes down one of the dragons.
Unclear which. Obviously not Drogon, but they do not really distinguish at all between Viserion and Rhaegal.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank Viserion.
And so I think this is like the moment where I think the writing in the show is a little weaker, because I think it's just a hesitance to like take down characters that the audience is actually invested in.
I would say the audience is pretty invested in the dragons, though. Probably more than like Beric, at least.
It's true.
So I don't really see it as that much as that, to be honest. I don't really see it as like not like killing a dragon instead of another main character, because I think people are going to be like, I think that's a pretty powerful moment when like a dragon dies. I don't know. I guess I have more of a problem with what happens to the dragon at the end of the episode, which we'll get to, than a dragon being killed in the first place. I think that's kind of okay. I guess it does, from a show perspective, defeat. There's so many theories about, like, the dragon has three heads for the Targaryen sigil and, like, the three dragons and three people riding the dragons.
Yeah, that kind of messes with a lot of things.
Yeah. But, so a lot of theories kind of went out the window with that, I would say.
Yeah.
But so one of the dragons dies, and then Jon, in his foolishness, is now very far away, and so tells Daenerys to go and is dragged into the water by some whites.
Yep.
So Daenerys leaves.
And then
Jon just fights off the whites and comes out of the water, as he does.
He's wearing very thick plot armor.
Very thick plot armor, and some... It's cold in the north and beyond the wall. So he's wearing, like, furs. Like, a lot of furs.
And you get that soaked with water.
That weighs you down. Like, it's not quite as bad as Bronn dragging metal-armed Jaime, like, through a mile of water. Not quite that bad. But still, like, how is he surviving that? Really, probably. And he's got the whites, like, pulling him down. Like, even if he fights them off, like, you'd think they wouldn't die.
He immediately, you know, comes out of the water, though. And is almost ready to fight.
Right,
the entire
army.
There,
like, he's still screwed.
And then another Deus Ex Machina, Benjen.
Which, just so much more of just, like, a random introduction. The dragons, at least, hey, Gendry went back, they sent the raven, you saw Daenerys leave. Benjen was just out of absolutely nowhere.
And then Benjen says, there's no time.
Right, he's like, okay, I'll put you on my horse, send you away, and I'll stay here. But, like, there's no... Maybe Benjen wanted to die. Like, sure. Maybe he's like, alright, I fulfilled my purpose being this kind of, like, half-alive creature. I'll die now, fighting off these whites. But, like, there was a solid 10 seconds at least between Jon getting on the horse and the whites attacking Benjen. And it took, like, 2 seconds for Jon to get on the horse.
I don't know.
So there was absolutely time.
I this is just another of, like, why...
And again, I think the thing is, the end result is something that would be that I'd be fine with, you know, hypothetically, of like, okay, well, I guess Benjen is coming in is too much of a Deus Ex Machina, but you know, given that, like, him saving Jon and dying in the process, fine. But, like, the way they do it just makes no sense, you know? If he was like, oh, I want to, like, I'm going to stay off and fight them so they don't come after you, you know, or you know, I want to fight them, I think this is my purpose, like, whatever. But, like, there's no time. It's just incorrect, even given, like, what they give you in the show.
Yeah.
Like, even if you don't, like, take your own logic outside of it. The logic within the show gives them time to both get away.
Yep.
So, I don't know. That was weird. Benjen is gone now. I guess that was the other character who died. I guess we're assuming. But, yeah, that was...
Never know with Benjen.
That's true. I mean, we thought he was dead in season one. He wasn't, came back in, like, season 4.
Yep.
Well,
so we come to the wall.
Yeah, they make it back. Well, everyone except John at this point. It looks like the Hound is taking, like, a boat with the White.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, Beric is staying. I'm just kind of curious, like, why those characters are doing what they're doing.
I guess, like, the Hound, Davos, and Gendry are going to go back.
Yeah, that could make sense. And then Beric, what's his purpose at this point? Who knows?
You know, Beric, he's a terrorist, according to the Lannisters, so...
That's true, that's true. He really fucked up with their plans in the Riverlands.
So I don't think they'll be really happy to see him, so...
That's true. Although, I mean, the Hound kind of betrayed the Lannisters, too.
So they wouldn't be... The Hound's got his own purposes for going.
Also, Cersei wanted to assassinate Gendry. Oh, that's true. Oh, my God, I didn't even realize that. That's why the Hound has to go. Of course. The Clegane Bowl.
This could really happen.
I think it's really going to happen. That's amazing. That's incredible. All right. No, that... Excellent point there. The Hound is going south, back to King's Landing with the White, who was south but Gregor Clegane. That will be... We're not going to get that next episode, I doubt. I don't think so.
Please.
But
what if season, we just threw out the whole,
season
like...
Season 8
is just an 8-episode fight between these two characters.
That would be incredible. That would be... Almost better than Gendry rowing being the last shot of the show.
how did Gendry get up the strength to run all the way back? Just rowing.
That's why he was the fastest. He really built up his leg muscles from going on that
going the erg.
So Daenerys on top of the wall, looking out, upset about the dragon, perhaps. Clearly, maybe. Much more concerned with Jon coming back.
They didn't even really name the dragon. She doesn't even name the dragon. She didn't even really talk about it.
Nope.
She just kind of, like, looks a little sad for some time.
And then Jorah's like, oh, like, maybe he'll go, you know, gotta leave. He hasn't come back yet. But then, just as she starts to, he comes back. Great timing there.
I liked how, you know, Davos, like, opens him up, and it kind of, like, really is, like, he's... The fur's, like, frozen on him, but the consequence of that is, you know, you see John and Danny sees all of his scars from when he got stabbed, and...
Yeah, clearly getting stabbed in the heart was not a metaphor.
Yeah.
After she sees that, so that's interesting. That doesn't get brought up this episode, but I think that she saw it was pretty, like, they let you know that that's what she was seeing, so I think that'll be brought up potentially next episode, or at some point at least, now that she's seen it.
Do you want to just finish out the scenes with Danny and John?
Yeah, I think we should do that. So they set off on a couple boats down to Dragonstone and then King's Landing, presumably. John awakens to find Daenerys looking over him, a little teary-eyed that he's woken up. She's forgotten all about the dragon at this point.
Fuck the dragon.
Just glad to see John's okay.
I've got another... I've got two more.
So they have a touching conversation.
John is like, Danny. And she's like, no one calls me that.
How did he know that that was, like, her nickname?
It's just not a John thing to do.
It was really strange that he did, but clearly another thing where they're really not necessarily in a bad way, but they're really hitting the nail over the head with, like, the Danny John romance. Obviously, there's the touching, you know, hand holding between the two. John declares that Daenerys he's gonna, you know, bend the knee. He's lying down, so he can't. Conveniently, but he's gonna serve Daenerys. You know, he recognizes her as queen, which I think that makes a lot of sense, given that, like, kind of he's kind of, like, beholden to the North way of, like, respecting you know, the actions of someone. Daenerys is clearly I think, like, now he knows that he has her support against the White Walkers, because she's, I guess that's in the one sense that she wants revenge for the dragon. She's like, oh, we're gonna kill the Night King.
So
he's got that support, and then he also saw that she, like, came to his rescue and, like, fought honorably.
So, this is interesting, because I maybe have interpreted it a bit differently. Maybe I am a bit too anxious for things, because I was like, my queen, real queen, like, marriage queen.
Okay, that's not what I saw it as. I think also yes, to an extent, but I think the main thing, because he does have the line about bending the knee, too.
Yeah.
So I think it's that he recognizes her as, like, the queen of the Seven Kingdoms. That's kind of all we get there, a touching thing. They're holding hands, and then there's kind of like this moment, and then Daenerys gets all awkward.
She's like, I gotta go.
So that's all we get for now. Nothing more between them, although I'm sure we will get more.
I'm sure.
We also have one more scene at Winterfell, where Sansa is going in Arya's room, presumably looking for the letter that Arya has, because for whatever reason she thinks it's really important. But instead of finding those, she finds some nice faces, as one does when going through Arya's things. And then
Arya appears and, like, what are you doing in my room?
God, Sansa, get out of my room! So Arya gets real creepy with Sansa, and she grabs the dagger and is like, oh, yeah, I can change people. I could even become you. I just need your face. As she's holding this dagger that was used to try to assassinate their brother. But then she doesn't obviously do anything.
I've got to think that Arya is just playing some kind of game on another level where she's, you know, pretending to threaten Sansa in order to, like, advance Littlefinger's plot, but
maybe, because, like, I really don't think that makes a lot of sense as far as, like, I get that Sansa would be, like, have conflict, or Arya would have conflict with Sansa, and that, you know, Arya would be, you know, not trusting of her. But, like, it doesn't really seem like she'd be at the point of, like, openly threatening her like that.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me, and I...
So, but there definitely could be an ulterior motive, though. That's something I would definitely buy at this point.
Yeah.
But as of now, we don't see that.
This whole plot, the whole Winterfell plot, just seems very kind of forced to me.
To an extent. I think the broad strokes of it makes sense to me, and just the way that they're hitting those checkpoints, I think, really don't make a lot of sense. Like, I think the small things that are driving characters' intentions and characters' actions don't really hold up upon examination, but what actions the characters are taking make sense given the characters. So I think it could be a lot worse, you know, because, like, the characters could just be acting completely out of character, but I wish that the smaller stuff made more sense. So then we get to the last scene of the episode, which is back beyond the wall, now with just the army of the dead, and they are taking the dragon up out of the water with giant chains that they just got.
I don't know what kind of they have, like, forges.
Do they have, like, supplies? Is this an art? Do they have, like, food stores and, like, wagons and whatever?
I really thought it was kind of a rough and ready operation.
Yeah.
And also, this is kind of an aside on this, but I saw a fun map of, like, here's, like, the distance between Hardhome and Eastwatch, which is, like, the whole season's trek of the White
last
Army.
Two seasons, really.
Right? And then, the map of where Jon has gone in that time of, like, up from the wall, down to Winterfell, over down the Dragonstone, up all the way back.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Yeah, I mean, it's inconsistent travel. Although, I guess they do walk. They are White Walkers, so it'd be slower. But yeah, so they bring up the dragon, and the Night King goes and awakens the dragon into a nice white dragon. So clearly, I don't love this, because I feel like it's, like, again, we talk about this, like, subversion of tropes that Game of Thrones has kind of been known for, and then just doing this of, like, okay, this one side has dragons, so it seems like, oh, we have to give a dragon to the other side, you know? Like, it would be cool to see a story where, like, the good guys had this, it wasn't like they had this weapon that automatically let them win, but it was cool, it'd be cool to see, like, okay, they had this one advantage, and then the whites had this other advantage. Obviously, they can kill the dragons, they did it in this episode. So it seemed like a little forced to me from a plot perspective to have, like, a dragon on both sides. It was, like, cool from our perspective, too, like, to see, like, oh, there's going to be a white dragon. I'm sure that'll be a really cool, like, fight scene from, like, a visual standpoint, when we see at some point, I'm sure, the dragons with Daenerys fighting the undead dragon now, but I kind of didn't love that it happened.
It just feels like too much in your own expectations. Like, I'm not, it just seems like the whites never do anything, or the White Walkers never do anything that, like, you wouldn't expect of them.
Right, I feel like they've morphed into, like, a very stereotypical, like, villain
and
type thing.
And this is kind of a question for a show like Game of Thrones, where you have dragons in your show. How do you maintain or, like, stay being the show that, like, isn't told the way that conventional stories are told? And I think sometimes, like, when you include dragons, people's, like, taste for thoughtful storytelling goes out the window, you know?
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, that'll lead to some cool things. I think there's positive aspects to that, but also I feel like I wish they'd gone in a different direction, personally.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. Now that we've had some time to talk about it, do you have a rating for this episode, Garrett?
I'm going to go with a 7.
7?
7.
I'm going to go with a 7.5. I think there was, like, enough cool action sequences and, you know, enough stuff that I liked in this, even though I think there was a lot that I found problematic with it. But, like, because of the spectacle, it was just enjoyable enough to watch from that point that I think I'm going to go slightly above a 7. But I think it wasn't, as far as, like, the Game of Thrones being known for, like, the second to last episode of a season, and obviously this is a little bit different given that there's only 7 episodes instead of 10. But I would say for second to last episodes, this was probably my least favorite of the series. Because, like, they had a battle, but it wasn't, like, the grand scale or, like, as you know, awesome.
I think it's just also, on a standpoint of, like, cinematics, fighting whites isn't very cinematic. Do you know what
I mean, Hardhome was pretty cinematic. Like, they did that cinematically very well. I think, you know, I would agree that in this episode, they had some cool shots of, like, the beyond the wall and, like, the landscapes. And then even, like, when the White Walkers are waiting, or, like, and when they're running into the lake. But the battle itself, I agree, it wasn't as, like, visually captivating as other battles have been. Honestly, even the Lutrain battle was more captivating from a visual standpoint. And so I think given that and given, like, I think there was just a lot. Like, there's things that I can accept from the show at this point, and I think, I mean, this is definitely something that we're going to talk about after the season's finale. Caitlin and I will talk about it. Like, kind of the what you can accept from the show versus, like, what you feel like is too much from, like, being lazy from, like, a plot standpoint. And I just feel like there was enough that was problematic about this episode where, like, it was still, like, good in a lot of ways, but it was also, there are a lot of things that I came out of it being, like, that didn't make sense to me, or, like, that bothered me while I was watching it. And so it, like, took me out of it in a lot of ways.
Yeah. There
we go. All right. So, that will be it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. You can listen to other episodes of What Is Pod May Never Die and all the podcasts from the Georgetown Voice on iTunes. Just search the Voice Podcast Network. You can also find the Voice Podcast Network on other podcast platforms if you don't use iTunes. You can read more from The Voice at www.georgetownvoice.com, and you can follow The Voice on Twitter at GTownVoice and at HalftimeGU. Thanks very much for listening, and we will see you one more time next week.